Mornings with Sue Montgomery. Donald Trump is in court in New York, where he's making history as the first former US president to stand trial in a criminal case. He denies falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels, 8 years ago. Mr. Trump spoke shortly before entering the courtroom.
This is a persecution like never before. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. And again, it's a case that should have never been brought. It's an assault on America. And that's why I'm very proud to be here. This is an assault on our country. And it's a country that's failing. It's a country that's run by an incompetent man who's very much involved in this case. This is really an attack on a political opponent. That's all it is.
Iran has sought to justify its unprecedented attack on Israel, telling Western countries they should appreciate its restraint. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said the strikes, involving more than 300 missiles and drones, were a limited act of self-defense. France, Germany and Britain are among those urging Israel to avoid any escalation. The British Prime Minister told Parliament his government was working urgently to prevent bloodshed. US scientists say record ocean temperatures have triggered the fourth global episode of mass coral bleaching. More from Georgina Ranard.
So what these US officials are saying is that we're now in the fourth global mass coral bleaching event. The first one was in 1998, and we've had two since then, and now we're in the fourth one. Coral is this very sensitive animal. It lives often in shallow waters. But when the water it's living in gets too hot, it gets stressed. It expels an algae that lives inside it, and then it can turn white, and often it can die. This is interesting also because we've been seeing for months these broken climate records, ocean heat driving up and really seeing unprecedented levels of warming in the oceans.
A leading member of Georgia's governing political party has been punched in the head during a parliamentary debate over a contentious law. There have also been protests outside parliament by critics who say the draft legislation aims to stifle free speech. Rehan Dimitri has been following events.
This is the moment when an opposition MP punched the governing Georgian Dreams Party's parliamentary leader during a committee hearing about a proposed law on foreign funding. This is the second attempt by Georgia's government to pass this bill that was abandoned last year due to mass protests. Critics have likened it to Russia's foreign agents law, which was gradually expanded in Russia to crush dissent. But the Georgian government has rejected any similarity with the Russian legislation.
BBC News. The US government is giving more than $6 billion in grants to the South Korean chipmaker Samsung to expand its facilities in Texas. President Biden wants to increase US-based production in one of the world's most important industrial sectors. Advanced chips will be vital in the development of artificial intelligence. The electric vehicle maker Tesla is cutting its global workforce by more than 10% as demand slows. The billionaire owner, Elon Musk, told staff it was a difficult decision but must be done to make Tesla lean and innovative. Michel Fleury is in New York.
Tesla is the world's largest maker of premium electric vehicles, and I think we've seen for a while now a fairly middling performance in terms of demand by consumers for these types of cars, not just Teslas, but across the board. In fact, there was an analyst at Barclays, Mr. Levy, Dan Levy, who described this as kind of switching from EV euphoria to EV winter, describing kind of the broader conditions in the market. So now we have this report essentially saying that Tesla apparently is cutting 10% of its workforce. That, if you look at sort of recent filings, suggests it's about 15,000 people from its global operations.
Customs officials in Senegal say they've confiscated more than a ton of cocaine on the border with Mali. They say it's the country's biggest ever land seizure of the drug. It was concealed in packets in a refrigerated truck. It's said to have a street value of almost $150 million. The former captain of Zambia's national football team, Rainford Kalaba, is said to be in a critical but stable condition after being involved in a car crash. He was the passenger in a vehicle that collided with an oncoming truck on Saturday. Kalaba helped Zambia win the Africa Cup of Nations in 2012. BBC News.
I feel lucky.
Wartstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th, and we're holding a raffle with some great prizes. Winners will take home one of five Summer Music Festival weekend passes, and we've added dinner for six with tequila tastings at Migrants, worth over $700, a pair of season passes to Forward Theater, stays from Marquette and Ruby Marie Hotels, and a crystal and onyx necklace from Goodman's Jewelers. Gift certificates from Sardine, Orange Tree Imports, 10 Pin Alleys, and much, much more. Plus, merch from Wine and Hop Shop, and of course, some great wart swag. Tickets are $3 each, 2 for 5 and 5 for 10. Drawing is at 5 p.m. at Wartstock, but you do not need to be present to win. Tickets are available at upcoming wart events or at the station. A complete list of prizes is on our website at wartfm.org. Good luck.
I feel lucky today.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Douglas Haynes, your Monday host. Last week, President Biden visited Madison College to announce a new college student debt relief proposal. Standing in front of a blue banner that said, President Joe Biden canceling student debt, he described a plan that would cancel debt for anyone who began repaying undergraduate loans more than 20 years ago. The proposal would also eliminate up to $20,000 in unpaid interest for people whose debt interest is larger than the amount they borrowed. This is part of the Biden administration's ongoing efforts to reduce the burden of student debt. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a broader 2022 debt relief plan last year. We'll talk about that on today's show, all of these new proposals, and we're going to find out more about how these proposals may affect people with student loan debt. And we'll, of course, explore the broader issues of skyrocketing college costs, the economic and social impacts of these costs, and all kinds of efforts to address them here in Wisconsin and across the country as well. So here to tell us more about these new plans, their impacts, we have two guests in the studio today. I'm happy to have with us Carol Trone, Interim Executive Director of Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. Welcome to A Public Affair, Carol.
Thank you very much.
And we also have with us in the studio Benjamin Lee, a board member of the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt and legal expert on student loan issues. Welcome back to A Public Affair, Benjamin.
Hey, thanks for having me, Douglas.
And welcome, listeners. We'd love for you to join our conversation here today on A Public Affair. If you have a question about the new Biden administration debt relief plans or would like to share how student loan debt has impacted your life, please do give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to hear your stories in particular of student loan debt, how it's impacted you, or if you have questions about how to go about addressing your student loan debt. Please join the conversation at 608-256-2001, extension 9. So we're going to get started with you today, Carol. And I'd like you to just start by giving us a brief overview of the Biden administration's newest proposals. You were there last week at this event at Madison College. You can tell us a little bit about that along the way as well. But we'll start with the proposals themselves first.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for asking. So these proposals, and again, I'll emphasize they're proposals at this point. And so these came out of a process of negotiated rulemaking that started early last fall, partly in response to see if there were other ways that the Biden administration could use existing policies and programs to address this priority. So they've outlined five groups of borrowers who would benefit. And first one would be those borrowers who, even while paying what they needed to be paying for loan repayment, would continue to see their interest rates increase. And so their loan balances have ballooned, and they are essentially not getting ahead. They're not paying down their debt. So they could have up to $20,000 of their interest balance canceled in this proposal. They would prioritize focusing on those low and middle income borrowers. And it's projected that of this group of borrowers, This benefit would affect about 25 million borrowers in the U.S., and of that number, 23 million of those would be forgiven all of their interest balance. The second group would be those borrowers who are eligible for programs that are already in place. So programs like the Public Service Loan Forgiveness or the administration's new loan repayment program called SAVE. So if they're eligible but perhaps have not applied, they would have their debts automatically canceled. The third group that would be affected under these proposals would be those borrowers who have undergraduate student loans, and they have started to they've been in repayment on those loans for at least 20 years. And for graduate students, their loans and being in repayment for at least 25 years. And so the fourth group of borrowers that would be affected would be borrowers who were in programs that the administration is now calling low financial value. You may know about them more as, you know, predatory colleges where students can demonstrate that they were cheated or defrauded. So they would have their debts waived. And then the final category of these five categories would be borrowers who are experiencing hardship and paying back their loans. So that might be those who are also under an unreasonable amount of debt because of medical bills or childcare costs. And this last group is in some ways maybe still in the earliest stages of being defined of, you know, who would be eligible for that.
Okay. So thanks for that great overview, Carol, of all the different people who are potentially, we should say, right, affected by these proposals, these new proposals from the Biden administration. Were you surprised by this announcement last week? And I know you said you were invited to be there. Tell us a little bit more about the context for last week's announcement.
Sure. So I think there had been some advance notice, some news coverage that these would be some of the things that would be laid out. I think, again, you know, this is coming from a process, a public process of discussion and negotiated rulemaking. So in that sense, it wasn't a huge surprise to hear this. I think it's a little hard to wrap your head around everyone that could be affected in this. You know, that it's like up to 30 million borrowers. And so that is, of course, and, you know, from here on out, that's where there's going to be a lot more discussion. There's going to be a period of public comment to actually get this across the finish line and be implemented. So, I mean, I wasn't surprised in the sense that that this administration has been working on different ways to bring that debt relief and loan forgiveness in, as they say, the tools, you know, that they have to do that. I don't know if you want me to talk about the event at all.
Sure. Or, yeah. Tell us about what the vibe was at Madison College there.
Yeah.
Biden came.
So I was a little bit surprised that, I mean, the campus was open, class was happening, students were coming and going. So all of that was, you know, normal course of events. It was the eclipse day,
right?
So that there was, I think, a lot of buzz about that and people carrying around their special glasses. The event was a fairly small audience. There were many people in that audience who had their own student loan debt stories. The event was introduced by two of those Wisconsin borrowers who talked about what that debt, how that debt impacted them and their futures. So it was a pretty like a sociable group of people, and we're on an education campus, so we think about students and student welfare a lot.
Absolutely. Were there any moments or aspects of those student stories or those debt, those borrower stories that stood out to you? Were they unique or were they very much part of the kinds of things you hear about at Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt?
Well, I mean, they weren't surprising. I think it's just reinforcing the frustration that many borrowers feel and that sense of, you know, particularly in some cases, not knowing if there's going to be any kind of responsiveness, not knowing if they're doing the right thing, how do they figure that out? You know, I think people also are always justifiably wary of scams. So I think there was a threat of that, of feeling like people want to know what the roadmap looks like. They want to know what they're getting into when they go into debt, and they want to know how they can repay that debt and know that information is clear and isn't going to change.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM Madison. My name is Douglas Haynes, and we're talking today about the new Biden administration student loan debt relief plans. If you have a question for my guests, Carol Trone and Benjamin Lee from the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt, please do give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd also love to hear your stories. Have you joined the conversation about what impacts this issue has had on you? I think that's a good segue where we just left off there to talk a little bit more about the broader context of efforts to alleviate student loan debt over the past couple of years, really, the last 4 years. This was a Biden administration promise coming in, right? And we'll turn it over to you, Benjamin Lee, to talk a little bit more about what's been happening before these announcements last week.
Yeah, absolutely. So remember that this is actually the administration's second attempt at debt relief. The first one was a lot easier and shorter to explain, right? It was basically $10K for everyone who wasn't a high earner, $20K if you got a Pell Grant when you went to your undergrad, and Pell Grant is need-based. So very easy elevator pitch. That got struck down by the Supreme Court. The administration came out, I think it was within 24 hours, announcing this negotiated rulemaking to try this sort of second attempt, which is you're now seeing that's what this announcement about an announcement essentially was, is that there's going to be this proposed rule coming out soon. And this is what's going to be in it. In addition to debt relief, there's been all sorts of work the department's been doing to try to get borrowers debt relief, more or less. So one of the things they've done is something called the PSLF waiver, which they then did sort of a second version of the same thing, the IDR and PSLF account adjustment. These are crediting borrowers with time, both in deferment and forbearance and in repayment that wouldn't normally count under these plans towards forgiveness. But because of low numbers and, alleged servicer misconduct and some other factors, the department's trying to make this wrong or right. And so lots of borrowers have been getting debt relief that way by basically saying, hey, these programs, if they were a little bit more flexible or if you had signed up or, you know, this, that, and the other, you would have already had debt relief. And so you're seeing this drumbeat of announcements of swaths of borrowers getting either updated counts where they're closer to debt relief or their loans are being completely forgiven. They are also coming out with regulations for like borrower defense to repayment. This is what's the phrase that we were deciding on earlier? Low financial value schools. So they're making things easier for borrowers to sort of get already promised relief under the law and the regulations.
Are these for both federal loans and private loans, or only the federal government loans?
Only federal. Everything we're going to talk about today is federal. Private is kind of its own animal, and there's not much that the White House can really do about private student loans.
Okay. Important that we kind of lay that out there, right?
Absolutely.
From the get-go. It sounds like there's been a lot happening over the past year and a lot to keep track of. And what we'll try to do a really good job of today is kind of clarify kind of action points maybe for people who are wondering, you know, is this something that I can get debt relief from or not? What's been happening now? What is the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt helping, helping people do that right now, identify those points of engagement? And then you can use both of you This is an opportunity to talk a little bit more about what the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt does. Carol, you want to start us off with that?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the question. So the coalition really was, I'd say, a grassroots kind of organic response to seeing the confusion in the student loan landscape. It started through some conversations with folks probably about 6 years ago or so. We have grown quite a bit since then. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We are nonpartisan, and we consist currently of 22 organizational partners. We invite into this coalition all the stakeholders that really should be at that table. So who we have right now, we have nonprofit organizations, we have institutions of higher education represented, we have some school districts represented, we have financial literacy groups, we have several of Wisconsin's state agencies have representation, and we have loan servicers also at the table. We are actively looking for, again, more representation from stakeholders from especially different parts of the state. So our website, I'll just say, is debtsmarts, plural, .org. And what we strive to do as an organization is bring clarity. And because there's a lot that is not clear right now in this landscape. So we both amplify the many programs and workshops and high quality resources that our organizational partners create. And so these will be for students across the borrower experience. So students before they're even taking on debt. So we're doing a lot around the FAFSA, which is also in the news a lot right now, but we won't talk about that here. and also current college students so that they understand what their options are, best practices for minimizing student loan debt. And then, of course, a big part of what we are doing is serving those who have student loan debt and are in the phase of repayment. So in addition to amplifying those programs, which and services from our members, we have a newsletter that people can subscribe to that share out some of those resources. These are resources that are, you know, these are not sponsored. We review them. They're quality and, you know, information first, student first. We run monthly webinars on various topics so that people can really dig in and just have a little bit better sense of how to understand their particular situation. And then in terms of direct service and support, we have a toll-free helpline. And that helpline is staffed Monday through Friday from 8 to 4:30. Can I give the number?
Yes.
Okay. Sure. So this is a toll-free number. You will talk to an expert and receive confidential help. We don't work with sensitive personal information. So this is more like a roadmap to let people be able to share their questions and we can give some guidance. So the number is 833-589-0750. And again, you can find that number on our website, which is debtsmarts.org. And we also have an email component to the helpline, and that email address is studentloanquestions@debtsmarts.org. And so we staff these, again, through generosity of our partners and their expertise. But it's, you know, it's a free service, and we, you know, we hope to be able to clarify some of the things that really have been very confusing.
And just to be clear, you have no relationship with lenders or
no
sort of obligation to lenders?
No. In fact, it's been very important to me leading the organization right now, and important to our members that it's very clear that this is not sponsorship of products. We do not get, referral you know, funding, yep. you know, for referrals to loans or anything like that. So it really, you know, and I'll just say, and we'll, we say this often, I had quite a bit of student loan debt for my graduate school days and three children who are taking on student loan debt. So it really has a personal element for me.
Yeah. You all did a great job already making clear what is a very complicated system. And a complicated, not only complicated system for repayment and just the loan system altogether, but now we have all this complicated layer of politics and legal issues on top of it. And we're definitely going to go into the legal issues and maybe a little bit of the politics here in a little bit. But I thought it might be helpful, Benjamin, for you to give us a little bit of context about how did we get here in terms of such a complicated system for students paying for college? In terms of the loans, right? I know that's a big question,
I was gonna
but
say,
I think it's
yeah.
worth talking a little bit about, like, why so many lenders? What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole lot that we could get into here, but in general, you know, most funding for higher education has sort of dwindled over the years, and that's left a lot on the table for federal student loans to sort of cover. So we've really put a lot on the individual to sort of fund their education that way. And the way that the sort of limits and things have gone with student loans, there hasn't been really much of a cap on what people can take out, especially for graduate school. And so schools haven't necessarily had a great interest in keeping their prices super low. They, if anything, it kind of seems like, okay, well, if they raise it on the federal side, then why would our prices not come up to accommodate that level of funding? So unfortunately, what you get is this sort of exploding cost of college compared to what, you know, generations before us had. And there's not a lot of congressional action in any forum, but also specifically in this one to address that problem. So then you have administrations trying to do things through agency work like the Department of Education to sort of address this issue. And then what are the sort of legal bounds of what an agency can do without congressional authority? That's what we're running into right now with all this confusion. And unfortunately, like many things, it's also been politicized. So now there's also lawsuits on top of that.
Yeah, that was actually really, really helpful, succinct overview of how we got here. Let's start with the legal issues a little bit. And again, maybe touch briefly on the politicization. They're interwoven, right? Tell our listeners about what happened with the last proposal and why the Supreme Court struck it down and where that left the Biden administration in terms of coming up with new proposals.
Yeah. So that was a 6-3 decision. And essentially, trying to keep this as neutral as possible. I think a lot of folks were wondering if anyone would have standing to sue. And that means that you have a particular sort of concrete injury because of a, you know, law or proposed regulation. And in this case, the majority of the Supreme Court seemed to get past that standing issue pretty quickly and determined that these states that had sued had standing. Mohela, unfortunately, which is part of, it's a sort of quasi-state entity out of Missouri. They kind of used that as a connection to the Missouri AG. The Missouri AG was one of the states that brought the case.
The Attorney General.
The Attorney General, yes, sorry. Please correct me when I get into acronym nonsense. So thank you. And so essentially what the court ruled, if I could boil it down to like a sentence, is that this was too big of a plan, too out there. It was the legal justification for it that the Department of Education used was the HEROES Act. And what the HEROES Act originally sort of what the intent was military members and then the public affected by wartime or natural disasters. It gave the Secretary of Education quite a broad sort of brush to sort of waive certain provisions and modify others. And folks on one side thought that this debt relief fell well within that, power, and others thought it was way too big and way too outside it. And the Supreme Court sided with that approach.
Okay. Thank you. That was really helpful. And then tell us about how the Biden administration then pivoted to use the 1965 Higher Education Act, maybe just kind of what's most significant about that different approach and how it might be more legally buoyant, let's say?
Yeah, you know, so the Biden administration has at least two things going on, right? There's the actual legal sort of pathway, and then there's also the politics of it, right? And those might overlap and intertwine, but they're also separate things. And so negotiated rulemaking is something that the department has to do under the Higher Education Act. And so they decided they had this ready to go as soon as the Supreme Court decision came out. So clearly this wasn't like a scrambled decision. They had been planning for this. So this was plan B, is that they would do negotiated rulemaking and they would go under this ability of the secretary to waive or modify certain debts, which is already sort of already in the Higher Education Act, which is the law. So you can't do regulations that are bigger than the law is the general rule. So some folks applauded that move and that pathway. Others, including a lot of borrower advocates, were not happy with it. They said this is going to take too long. It's going to get bogged down. And they should have just done the relief, dared people to sue them, and then come up with, you know, whatever justifications they needed to at that point. So there's some tactical moves here as well. The one thing about negotiated rulemaking is that it's a long, drawn-out process, but with many opportunities for sort of visits or announcements like you saw in Madison, right? It's the steady drumbeat of, look at all we're doing, we're trying, here's all the obstacles, here's who's fighting us. So, you know, I don't know if that played into their calculus, if it was a pure legal decision, if it was political, if it was both, but those are kind of the factors at play.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Carol Trone and Benjamin Lee from the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. Benjamin, a board member there, and Carol, the interim executive director. We're jumping off of President Biden's visit to Madison last week to announce a few new initiatives on student debt. Relief, student loan debt relief. And we're talking also then about the broader context for those new initiatives, the likelihood of them becoming enacted, and where this is headed next in terms of relief coming for people who have taken out money to pay for college. So we'd love to hear your perspectives on this, also your stories of how student loan debt has impacted your life. You can give us a call at 608-256-2001 extension 9 to join the conversation. I'm going to follow up here on what Benjamin was just talking about in terms of the political and legal landscape and boil that down into sort of the on-the-ground Republican argument, which is that this is an effort, the Biden administration's student loan debt relief programs, to federally subsidize people who make the choice to go to college, that it's somehow like unfair because it's federal favors for people who go to college. That's one of the critiques out there, right? How do you respond to that critique? Do you feel like that's a well-founded critique, I guess, for people who are trying to understand, well, why should we do something about student loan debt relief? Either Carol or Benjamin.
I can take the first shot at it here. So tough question, obviously. I think, you know, generally, you know, we spend our money where our values are as a country, and people have very differing values at the moment when it comes to higher education, right? And so you're seeing that play out in the context of student loans. Which is really unfortunate because, you know, our focus, like as a coalition, I know Carol has student loans. I have student loans. Like it seems like everyone I know has student loans. To a lot of us, all that stuff is superfluous and it almost doesn't matter, right? It's okay. What can I actually do? What's going to benefit me? How is this going to help me get out of this situation or at least address something that has clearly kind of gone off the rails for a lot of people? And I think, you know, folks making the argument that we shouldn't be subsidizing this. I think a well-educated workforce is still in most people's best interest. And I would also say that for folks trying to be upward socially mobile, all the studies and all the data, despite all the noise you might see in the clickbait, is still the best pathway for people in America to achieve that is a higher education or credential after high school.
So both on the level of common good and individual quote-unquote success, you feel like there are strong arguments to say it's worth supporting people getting out from under debt.
Yes, yeah. And I would also say I think even some of the detractors would agree with that statement. It's perhaps more that they're seizing on this idea that we shouldn't be subsidizing people's bad choices is the way that they phrase it. You know, a system that creates winners and losers, essentially. And we've seen some of that with these low financial value schools, right? The Department of Education and accrediting agencies did not do a good job gatekeeping on the front end. You have students going to these schools, getting into student loan debt and getting nothing of value from it. Is that a fair situation for those borrowers? I think we can all agree that it is not.
And also that almost seems a little bit like a straw man to me, because that certainly it detracts or distracts a little bit from the larger issue of the way that college is funded now is privatized, right? Even in public institutions, as you described earlier, Benjamin, people have no choice other than to pay the price tag if they want to go to college, right? So to focus a political argument just on those predatory institutions that are taking advantage of people seems to me like it just detracts from the larger issue.
Yeah, I mean, as usual, right? It's way more complicated and nuanced than anything that you're seeing in terms of headlines and, of course, than politicians are saying. So there's a lot at play here.
Yeah. Carol, would you like to jump in on that issue, responding to that critique?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've described what the critique is well. And particularly right now, we are seeing I guess what I would call almost a growing skepticism in the value of higher education. And so that growing skepticism is fueling into, I think, this debate of why should taxpayer money be going towards these debt choices. I will just say that, I think as Benjamin said, you put your money where your priorities are, you should be. If you go back to things like the public service loan forgiveness, which I believe first rolled out in 2007, so not a new program, but the whole point was that we need public servants, we need nurses, we need teachers. Our state in particular here, we need those people, and we're seeing the struggles of not having them. And so there is a whole much bigger and needed conversation about how we do invest in the workforce that Wisconsin needs. And so this may look for some like this is a after the fact kind of way of addressing the issue. And it does become politicized, unfortunately.
Let's clarify just that particular aspect of debt relief or potential debt relief right now, which is for public servants, nurses and teachers, for example. Where does it stand both for nurses and teachers who are working now in those fields and have debt, and then students in college right now studying those fields, wanting to be teachers and nurses and taking out debt? Benjamin?
Yeah, so you're talking about public service loan forgiveness, and this is a law that George Bush, I believe, signed into law in 2007, so this was bipartisan, and essentially 10 years of repayment and the remaining balance of your student loans is forgiven for federal student loans if you are working for a qualifying employer and making qualifying payments during those 10 years. And I think for borrowers wondering if this program is going to be around for them, you know, it is a law. So I usually say, you know, nothing is promised, but is Congress really doing much of anything one way or another on anything? No. So chances are good that it is still there. It is still a law. I personally am pursuing public service loan forgiveness. I've got about a year left. So, you know, it's something I'm very, very familiar with. And I would just encourage folks that are, you know, thinking about careers in public service to not discount the power of this program, especially combined with the SAVE plan, which is extremely borrower friendly and very generous compared to other income driven repayment plans. So, you know, a job with maybe a lower salary, but that is intrinsically rewarding or something of a benefit to society, depends on your personal calculus. But as of right now, that program, public service loan forgiveness, is a law, and it isn't there's no lawsuits. There is nothing touching it right now.
Do you want to add any more detail about what you just mentioned, the SAVE?
So SAVE is the department's acronym for Saving on a Valuable Education, which is their most recent income-driven repayment plan. And you can use this, so Public service loan forgiveness is literally just a forgiveness program. You still need a way to repay your loans during those 10 years. Save is the most generous of these IDR, income-driven repayment plans. And what this does is your monthly payment is tied to your family size and your income, your adjusted gross income. So theoretically, the payment should be affordable. So for borrowers who take on a lot of debt, maybe need a graduate degree, but then decide to go into public service, the combination of Save lowering that monthly payment and knowing that you only have to pay it for 10 years could really be a great path forward.
I see. So it allows, it's just another kind of aspect of the overall package for people, public servants, that if they have loans, they can expect that they're done in 10 years, but also the actual payments they will make while they're paying off will be lower than potentially other loans.
Correct. And we've had IDR, income-driven repayment plans available since the mid-90s. So they're not new. Save is just by far the most generous one.
Okay.
And the one that is, you know, for borrowers, there's almost no reason that you would be in another plan. You have to have a pretty unique situation. However, there are two different lawsuits trying to undo that plan at the moment from different blocks of states. Whether those lawsuits have any chance of actually derailing it, I'm guessing probably not, but you know, never say never. Right. But that program has already been almost fully implemented. It'll be fully implemented by July 1 of this year. And it's very borrower friendly. And I encourage borrowers who are paying under any other plan to at least look into Save and see what they could be maybe paying under it.
Are there other similar initiatives right now that are already in effect, like the public servant loan forgiveness, that you would like to highlight for listeners that are not pending, you know, approval? They're not proposals. There are things that can really help out right now.
I would actually like to add, just on in addition to what Sure. we've just been saying about PSLF. So as we've pointed out, it's not a new program. And you do under the current plan, you do have to put in 10 years of payments working for a qualifying employer. So this wasn't like a quick, easy path to forgiveness. It wasn't really until about 2017 that many borrowers were hit with the pretty rude news that for one reason or another, they weren't in the right repayment plan, or they hadn't recertified, or things like that. And that, and the numbers were crazy. It was something like 99% of people who thought that they were in the plan, they thought they were making the appropriate qualifying progress towards that forgiveness date, would find out that they hadn't. So one thing that I have noted in working with our borrowers is, and many of them are teachers or people who are eligible for that PSLF, that's the story they heard, which was a true story from 5 or 6 years ago. And they know less about the reforms that are taking place. And so it's not, to answer your question, that isn't necessarily new. Mm-hmm. PSLF isn't new, but I would say it is newly much more operational. And so one thing we want to stress at the coalition is don't give up. Like, realize actually, and if you had been turned down before, there are new processes in place to get your eligible payments back on track.
That must have been very demoralizing, I imagine, for people back in 2017, 2018 to hear that, just as it was last year when the Supreme Court decision came down about the most recent debt relief plans from the Biden administration. Because as we were talking about before the show, Benjamin, you know, I had students who were signing up already in, that would have been the fall of 2022, right? Who were ready to go. Yeah, I've got debt relief, right? And then suddenly, poof, it's gone. What have you been hearing from borrowers about their trust or general kind of morale in regards to whether the Biden administration is really going to help them out?
Yeah, I think, you know, mistrust is a great word. Confusion and mistrust, that is sort of the student loan landscape for borrowers in a nutshell. And I think most borrowers realize that there are good programs and some good efforts going on, but are very unclear about how it could impact them. Many of them are not sure whether they would qualify. And unfortunately, trying to make this round of debt relief a little bit more targeted means that we had to go through at the top of the show, right? Five categories, and you kind of have to explain them. There isn't this neat elevator pitch where someone can just say, oh, I qualify for that. So there is a lot of confusion out there. And, you know, I would encourage borrowers, like Carol said, it was a great point. You know, don't give up. If you've been denied before, don't think that that's the be-all, end-all. You know, we pumped the toll-free number, the email address. Obviously, have your contact information up to date with your servicer. If you don't know who your servicer is, you can go to studentaid.gov, log in there, create a login if you hadn't. It'll tell you what type of loans you have, who you need to contact for them. You know, if you bury your head in the sand or kind of just throw your hands up, that's almost never a good outcome in the student loan space. So unfortunately, you have to be a little bit of a self-starter and kind of take control over some of the, you know, student loan aspects.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Benjamin Lee, board member of the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt, and Carol Trone, an interim executive director of Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. We're talking about the recent Biden administration announcements for proposals to provide a targeted debt relief. But we're also talking about the larger issue and how it affects people. And if you have a comment or a question about that, there's still time to give us a call. The number is 608-256-2001, extension 9. So I think we should definitely talk in the time we have left here about the prospects for these most recent proposals. We were just talking about what happened with the last round. What is the likelihood these will be enacted? What does that look like? What's the timeline for people who do fall under those groups that these recent targeted proposals will help out or potentially help out?
Yeah, I can at least start with like what are the regulatory timeline, because these are proposed regulations, right? So normally what would happen is a proposed rule would come out, which supposedly will happen soon. You get a public comment period, 60 to 90 days typically. And then the department publishes a final rule, which is the finalized reg or regulation, sometime before November 1st. That means that it would be implemented by July 1, 2025. However, when the president was here and he did his announcement, he was already talking about providing some of this relief in fall, which makes me know that they're talking about doing what's called early implementation for at least some of these regulations, if they are able to sort of get them through. Now, that pathway does not account for lawsuits, which could, anything is possible, right? So you could have a lawsuit that still allows them to move forward. You could have a lawsuit that puts on an injunction that they can't do anything until the lawsuit is resolved. I think the one thing we can say for certainty is that there's going to be lawsuits. What the outcome of those lawsuits, what the impact to borrowers is, I think is much more unknown at this point.
Yeah, I think that the Biden administration has framed this in terms of looking very closely at the Supreme Court decision and their rationale for striking down the earlier forgiveness proposal and tying their rationale for this newest round in a much tighter fashion. So I think in part that's why you see five, you know, very specific categories of borrowers. I do think it is, I think it will be a priority for them to be able to move forward on this. And, you know, again, some of the numbers that we shared earlier in the show, this could affect, if all of the proposals are passed and implemented as they look right now, would be affecting close to 30 million borrowers.
So I'm going to, again, zoom out and ask a bigger question, which somebody might be wondering, again, about this complicated system we have and all the different regulations for targeted groups, et cetera. Why doesn't the federal government just cancel interest on student loans altogether? Why is the federal government charging interest on college costs for students, for example, who go to public institutions, for one?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And the answer for a lot of this stuff is that it's just statutory. It's a law and it's been on the books forever. And how they calculate the rates each year on student loans, that's statutory. And so it would require Congress to actually do something, which is something that isn't in abundant supply, right? Okay. Like congressional action. So you'll see folks propose solutions, you know, laws that address this, but they just never gain any traction. So again, you have the agency, the Department of Education, doing kind of what it can because there isn't congressional action addressing what, you know, should someone have a student loan from the federal government that's at an 8 or 9% interest rate? I think most people would say no, that doesn't seem reasonable.
So Congress could just act and say we're no longer going to charge interest on student loans if Congress wanted.
If they want to pass a law saying that, they absolutely could do it, yes.
What other kinds of action would you both advocate for or do you foresee? We can take it either direction coming in this year or over the next couple of years, Carol?
Yeah, I mean, related, you know, to what we've been talking about, the Higher Education Act hasn't been reauthorized, I think, since about 2007. That would be the process by which Congress would review policies and things like charging interest and how much aid should there be available to low-income students or students in certain populations. So, I mean, one thing in the student aid community that we have advocated for many years is to have the Pell Grant actually double to keep up with the rising costs of college. One reason people are getting in more debt is the Pell Grant used to pretty much cover most, if not all, of a student's tuition costs. And Pell Grant is for, it's need-based, so it's, yeah, it's for low-income students. Now there's been some recent climbs in the amount. I believe it's at $7,395 is the maximum amount. That still is not going to get you, yeah, even halfway to a college tuition.
We have a caller on the line who wants to ask about social mobility and student debt, this larger context of the impacts of student debt. Deanna, welcome to Public Affair.
Good afternoon to everyone. My name is Diane. I am a goddess. I'm making a joke. I tuned in late, so you may have talked about this, but when I listen to all the complications with the resolution of debt, when I think about all these student loans, what occurs to me, it is a great mechanism for preventing social mobility. Have you talked about this?
So you're saying student debt prevents social mobility when people have large amounts of debt, Diane?
That is part of it, yes. And all the problem, I mean, the very fact that, you know, they have to take this debt out. They already come from disadvantaged class or ethnicities or both. Now when we have all these problems trying to resolve the debt, we have these high interest rates. There's a whole sector of the population that's prevented from improving their lot and the lot of their descendants because of this debt.
Yeah, we touched on that briefly earlier, Diane, but I think it's definitely worth coming back to.
I'm sorry. I tuned in late.
No, that's okay. I appreciate you bringing it back up. And I think we should talk about it here a little bit more to wrap up the show. And I'm sorry I got your name there wrong, Diane. But thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
And Carol wants to speak to that.
Yeah, so thank you, Diane, for calling in and for your question and your observation. What we do know is exactly what you're saying, is that certain borrowers, certain populations are impacted very negatively by this debt. And we have, you know, we share this message that education brings social mobility. When we dig into the numbers and learn more about who these borrowers are, we see that, in fact, it doesn't work that way for all borrowers. One of our coalition members is with the Institute for Research on Poverty here at the UW-Madison, and they recently hosted a webinar talking about the growing burden of Black student debt. And this is, you know, a prime example of how we need to be much more targeted, and we need to understand the issues in a much more nuanced way of who is affected and who isn't, and then make sure that we're really addressing the issues that most negatively impact borrowers. We do know that in, you know, broad stroke, we know that still most good jobs, most middle class and upward kinds of jobs in terms of pay do require some post-secondary education. We actually have some information on our website about those kinds of findings. But that doesn't remove the fact that there are some borrowers that really are overwhelmed by the debt and haven't been served well by the debt.
Benjamin, in your work, do you hear from individual borrowers about ways that they feel like their lives, their possibilities are shut down or limited by their student loan debt?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite places to go for student loan information is actually the Reddit student loan forum, because it's just crowdsourced. It's very open. It's very honest. It's very up to date. So I can see what's happening to borrowers sort of in real time, at least those that care to share on that forum. And, you know, a lot of the stories are quite heartbreaking. These folks that, you know, at 18, you can't do a whole lot, but you can sign away for $100,000 of private student loan debt pretty quickly. And that can really change the trajectory of your life and what you're able to do, you know, what kinds of jobs you can get, where you can rent, all sorts of things, even, you know, romantic partners, families. All these things are at play, and it ties, at least in part for a lot of borrowers, to student loan debt. So I think it was a really good call from Diane. And, you know, when we've made such a complicated student loan system, and the more complicated something is, the more likely it is to break. We've gotten pretty close to that a couple times, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years, where things are just not working the way they're supposed to. Borrowers are, you know, not engaging because they don't want to get burned again. They're confused. They're angry. They don't trust anyone. And, you know, I really hope that it sort of levels out here and we get back to a place of more stability for everyone involved and, you know, better decision making.
I think that's a great place to turn it back here at the end of the show to resources for borrowers, and tell us a little bit more once more about the Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt and how people can reach out.
Sure. So you can find our resources at our website, and that is debtsmarts.org. We have a toll-free number where you can get expert help in a confidential setting. The number is 833-589-0750. You can also email us your student loan questions at the email studentloanquestions@debtsmarts.org. The federal student aid website, which is studentaid.gov, is really a go-to. They have loan repayment tools, so you can see what plans are available. You can log in and see what federal loans that you have. And there will be continuing to be more information on that site directly for borrowers.
That's Carol Trone, Interim Executive Director of Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. Thanks so much for coming in to the studio today, Carol. It was great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we've also been joined by Benjamin Lee, board member of Wisconsin Coalition on Student Debt. Thanks for coming in, Benjamin.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. If you have appreciated this conversation today, we would appreciate you sharing it, either from the Wart Public Affair Archive or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm your host, Douglas Haynes, and I'd like to thank today's engineer, Andrew Thomas, producer Jade Isiri Ramos, news director Shali Pittman, and receptionist Amy Lutsky. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Bookbeat. On today's show, Harris host Sarah Botke talks with Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman about her new book, Exploding Head. And supported live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and supported live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen.
listen and support it. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Donald Trump is in court in New York, where he's making history as the first former U.S. president to stand trial in a criminal case. He denies falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels, 8 years ago. Neda Taufik is outside the courthouse in Manhattan.
Inside, all of the key players are gathered in that courtroom as we await that kind of high-stakes process of selecting a jury. Donald Trump, of course, himself sitting there with both groups of his attorneys, and his campaign a spokesperson is in the room as well. Also, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, there to watch closely as his team argues this case. Of course, the stakes are incredibly high for him as well. He was the first district attorney to bring